Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets podcast. My name is Graham Davis. I'm the digital editor at Investors Chronicle. I'm standing in this week for our editor, John Heumann, who's off sloshing around the Lake District somewhere in the rain, probably. He's on holiday this week. This week, I'm joined by our companies editor, Stephen Wilmot. How are you, Stephen?
Very good, Graham.
And our news editor, Bradley Gerrard. How are you?
I'm great as well, thank you.
Good. And over there in the control room this week, which seems to change us every week at the moment, Thoran Mohammed. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Graham.
Excellent. Right, well, it's been a busy week, partly because Monday was a bank holiday, so we came in had to get a magazine out in 2 days, which is always a bit of a feat. And also, we've still got these results, the results hangover from the rush at the end of August, and that has sort of been rolling on and will roll on through most of September, as I'm sure Stephen will tell us more about in a few moments' time. First of all, though, Bradley, news. It's been another turbulent week on the markets. What's been going on?
Yeah, it has. It's been busy again. China kind of been front and centre of things. The front of the FT this morning is pretty interesting with foreign investors, I suppose, getting pretty freaked out by the allegations, I guess is best to call it, of people being questioned, arrested, worse in China for potentially manipulating markets in the eyes of the authorities there.
Yeah.
So that's worrying people, and the Chinese markets continue to...
It doesn't feel entirely comfortable. To us from the outside, at least. And I'm sure for those being detained, it's not very comfortable either.
Indeed, and I think that is a key worry for people. The Chinese market is still falling. Yeah. Everyone else has kind of had a bit of a reality check, and we're not sort of in the period we were a couple of weeks ago when it was a massive red across all indexes. There's a bit more sort of sensibility out there now, but not plain sailing.
I noticed that China's on a public holiday today, though, so it seems a lot calmer.
I'm sure that's the only reason why it would be calm at the moment.
Yeah. But also, I guess, last week we talked about this, and we expected that with the sort of end of the summer holidays, the A team, as it were, coming back into the offices, we may get a bit more of rational behaviour in the Western markets, at least.
Yeah, and it seems that's been happening. Again, and also there's some good data which we kind of cover in a 7 days spread for the US. Auto sales there, well, largely derived from data from two of their biggest companies, was strong in August in spite of the turbulence in markets. And also the US has continued to create a strong amount of jobs as well, which I kind of suggest there could, it's a point in the camp for let's raise rates kind of thing. Obviously, the Fed, which meets in the middle of this month, might well find reasons to not raise rates. And I think the consensus is still on a September rise in the US. But who knows? I mean, they could use plenty of things to say that now is not the right time.
I mean, certainly you would have thought it's not going to help volatility in emerging markets at the very least.
No,
should
I mean,
they raise rates?
Yeah, that's a potential effect of the US raising rates. Obviously, emerging markets are struggling on a number of sort of fronts anyway at the moment already because the strong dollar doesn't help them. Low commodity prices don't help them. But
it's all very reminiscent, isn't it, of the mid-90s when the Fed raised its rates. And obviously that's usually cited as a reason why there was this emerging market crisis.
Asian
in 97.
Crisis,
I mean, people argue emerging market countries aren't quite in the same state as they were back then. But even so, the potential problems of the US raising rates is it will just add to the current pressures.
And coupled with the slowdown in China as well. We're heading towards QT instead of QE.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a very interesting report actually from Deutsche Bank. And while on the face of it, you think, okay, well, of course, quantitative easing will have to stop at some point. I don't think, well, I certainly have never, and I'm sure there are people out there who have, but I've never really considered the impact of it, actually. And Deutsche Bank suggests it could be really, really significant because having large FX reserves around the world creates an effect, obviously. And the reverse of that also has an effect of which Deutsche Bank says would be a pretty major impact on global fixed income. They predict it will push yields up and therefore prices down. So that's basically a a bit of a warning signal for fixed income, which arguably has been flashing for a while. I think even for the past couple of years, I've been writing, you know, stories when I was an investment advisor about, you know, the fears of a bond bear market, and it hasn't transpired yet. Maybe this Deutsche paper is raising the signal for what could prompt it.
It just ties into my taking stock column this week, because it's basically looking back at almost three centuries of financial history, which I always like the historical angle. The Chancellor George Osborne in July redeemed the outstanding perpetual debt, which was left over from the Victorian and Georgian eras. And I guess the thing to bear in mind is that he could do this because long-term bond yields have got to such a low point, even relative to where they were at the end of the 19th century, was extremely low. Let's not forget that there was this, what was called the Long Depression, starting in the 1870s and 1880s, where commodity prices fell a lot. But actually, it was actually a period of globalization, and the commodity prices fell in part because lots of countries were coming into global markets as a result of the British Empire, partly. But anyway, it's just there was this very, very long bull market in bonds, government bonds, which started in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo and continued right into the end of the 19th century. And that's why everyone in Victorian England invested in the funds or gilts. And then it did turn. And it's always puzzled me, actually, why property underperformed in Edwardian Britain. And it's not kind of what you'd think, given how much Edwardian property there is around. but it is, that's definitely true. And even though it was a very prosperous society, and it does give you a sense of what, you know, the peak in the Victorian era was 1897. And then after that, you know, rates were gradually rising. This is even before the First World War. Usually it's assumed that it was the inflationary effect of the First World War that created basically ended the golden era for Imperial Britain. But actually, no, it stopped a little earlier, and you know, property underperformed for one thing. So it's just it's an interesting. And anyway, yeah, George Osborne has been able to redeem these old sort of late 19th century bonds because interest rates have got to that point again. So
yeah,
anyway, there's
it makes sense to do it, I suppose. And yeah, that's the problem, as you say, the yields are at such low levels that, yeah, this is the concern kind of raised in the Deutsche paper, that they are so low, they've been low for a very long time, and now there is a real catalyst for them to potentially turn the other way. So yeah, so
watch out for quantitative tightening there. Yeah. Interesting times. And you know, there's going to be an interesting final quarter of the year, I think. So looking at company specific stuff, Bradley, there was a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, and this is what one of them is very interesting, the chief executive ASOS.
I mean, it seems to have come as a bit of a surprise yesterday. The shares did initially fall quite strongly. I think they fell about 6% from memory. They had recouped a bit of that by the end of the day, roughly half the last time I checked. I guess that's partly because the reins are being handed to the chief operating officer, Nick Baton, who is, he's been at the company a very long time as well. So there's a positive in that. You know, ASOS isn't having to go out into the market to try and, you know, sort of a big golden hello to somebody in the city, which is obviously a positive thing. But yeah, I mean, it's...
I mean, he's synonymous with this company.
Well, that's Robertson, the thing,
I mean, I remember this when it was a penny stock back in the early, just after the dot-com boom, and when it was known as seen on screen, and you could go on it and buy, you know, the jacket seen on Keanu Reeves in the last movie sort of thing. And it's compared to that this isn't a major business now.
Yeah, no, it's grown a significant amount, as you say. I mean, well, in the piece we say, you know, it floated in the AIM market in 2001 at a price of 20p. It's reached a high last year of £70. I mean, it's about less than half of that now. But even so, even if you take, you know, if you bought in at 20p and you cashed out around £30, I mean, you've not done too badly there. Hopefully you cashed out at 70 and then you're really laughing. But no, it's the end of an era for ASOS, with such a prominent figure going. People, investors, like tenure. I mean, they like people to be at businesses a long time because it provides stability. It means that the person running the company knows the business well and can navigate good and bad markets. So it is the end of a chapter for ASOS. We will see what happens.
It is a grown-up business now, so it should be able to handle.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different from when Mr. Robertson started it. So yeah, it's living in an era of arguably not much direct competition, but more and more stores are obviously selling online. So there's the aspect of that competition of more businesses sell online, so it has more competition. But in terms of just what ASOS does, there aren't too many comparables, having chatted to Harriet Russell, who's our retail correspondent.
And Harriet's kept that one on a hold for now. We're sort of not mad on it, but...
Yeah, just because of the potential change. Obviously, it'd be interesting to see if Nick Baton has any strategy changes up his sleeve. Or I think we just need a bit to know a bit more from the company before we change our mind.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the other themes running through, well, actually, not the news section, we're running into the new spotlight here, which was written by Theron. And it's a theme that doesn't want to go away at the moment, M&A and deal making. And we've had, you know, further news out this morning with Arga Food Service, and the battle to buy Arga seems to be moving on a notch again this morning. So you would think at this time of year, August time, especially when the markets have been very volatile, that deal making would just disappear. But Theron, as you point out in New Spotlight, it's not happening this time, is it?
Yeah, so even before the China issues and many of the problems of the year, it was quite a strong year for deals. But even after all these things, these various crises took place, it hasn't really curbed the appetite for deals. So in my story, I talk about a broad range, a lot in the US, and quite a few big names in the UK as well that have made a lot of deals. And my sector, the UK technology sector, has had quite a few prominent players snapped up in the past year alone.
Yeah, Innovation Group this week.
Yeah, exactly.
There's another one. And there's big money changing hands in the States, though. I just saw the Berkshire Hathaway bid. I mean, it's $32 billion. Is it just because of cheap money, or are these people casting around for growth?
I think it's actually a bit of both. So there's this this strengthening U.S. economy, and cheap cash definitely makes it easier to do a deal and gives management confidence in the U.S. to do one. But also in sort of a so-so global climate, everyone's looking to find growth somewhere else.
Hmm.
The Berkshire Hathaway deal was a bit different in a way, which is interesting because it was deliberately he was looking for value. I mean, as you'd expect from Warren Buffett. A lot of these deals are in quite buoyant sectors, notably technology.
Yeah.
Whereas he was actually looking for an oil and gas. So he bought Precision Cast Parts, which, it's not a company I know well, but I gather it's an engineer which has exposure to oil and gas markets.
Right.
And has been, I mean, like many in Britain, we know the British ones better. You know, Weir, which has just been kicked out of the FTSE 100, for example. These companies have been suffering from their exposure to the oil and gas markets, and he spotted a bargain. So I guess there's a thing about M&A, there are always different reasons for it. But
I mean, the oil and gas sector, as Theron pointed out in his piece here, has been a major hotbed of activity. But that, as you say, there are different reasons always, and that is a sector that's bombed out.
Yes, I guess there's consolidation. There's Shell and BG, obviously the big headline there. But on the other hand, there's technology where it's hardly a sign of, you know, consolidation in a kind of oversupplied market. It's quite the opposite. It's sort of animal spirits being at their highest end.
Mm.
Yeah. So on a similar note to the Buffett deal, there is Aveva, which is a software group that actually has a lot of exposure to the oil and gas sector. So in that case, it's a technology company that's been hit by oil and gas. A value opportunity has arisen for Schneider Electric.
And it looks like, I mean, it's certainly shareholders in the UK in certain situations are benefiting from the fact that there's competition for some companies, Arga being the latest one. But
we've got two ongoing bid battles, which is really interesting. These things don't come up all that often. The fact that we have two at the same time is quite interesting. So Arga Rangemaster is being fought over by two American bidders. The latest is Whirlpool. Came out with a...
Middleby made a bid a month or so ago.
Yeah, exactly. Middleby made a bid in July, which Arga immediately said it had agreed to. I mean, Arga's a long-suffering company, and so it's shareholders, so it's perhaps not hugely surprising that it agreed to the bid. And so they got one of the announcements saying, Middleby and Arga are pleased to announce they've agreed on terms of a bid, blah, blah, blah. This sort of happy jamboree was sort of interrupted on Tuesday by news that Whirlpool, which is a US corporation, is contemplating a counter bid. And then we got a note this morning from Middleby saying, a rather sort of irritated note saying, you know, we would encourage investors to question the motives of Whirlpool.
Of course they would.
Yeah, which, I mean, basically trying to imply that, you know, there was no, that there wasn't a great chance of an offer from actually transpiring from Whirlpool, whereas if they stuck with the Middleby bid, then they'd have their cash in, you know, under 4 weeks or something. So, which is true.
Which is true, but I mean, any right-minded investor would sit on their hands now for a few days at least.
Well, quite. I mean, if you're still an investor in Argo, it's not that you've wanted your money quick.
Exactly, because the Middleby bid is now underpinning that share price, and right. Anything from Whirlpool or maybe Middleby, you know, who knows? Middleby could be forced to pay a little bit more, I suppose.
But. Yeah, and the other situation. I mean, Bradley, you've been writing about, haven't you? Because bwin.party, sorry, such a silly name. Yep. So it's always hard to say that fluently. Yeah, is being fought over by 888 and GVC, all of which had their results on Friday, or was it Thursday? Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a hazy day, whichever day it was. I'm pretty sure it was Thursday. Yeah, you're right, it's an interesting one. It's been going on for a while. I think if my memory serves me correctly, which hopefully it does, bwin is recommending the 888 offer, but GVC isn't going away. GVC is keen to...
It was one of those sort of ambivalent kind of announcements, wasn't it, where they said, oh, we're looking at the GVC offer, but this doesn't affect our pledge to support the 888 offer.
It felt like they were trying to sort of a bit of flip-flopping. They were trying to please both parties. It's like sort of trying to pick your favourite child or something if one of them asks you. You know, you've got to try and say positive things about both of them. It kind of seems... it seems interesting. There's obviously... a desire to take bwin over by somebody. It looks like if you're a shareholder in that, talking about underpinning share prices, I mean, you know, it's likely somebody will buy bwin. And
you would just sit on your hands for now.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of consolidation in the gambling industry has been sort of frenetic recently. And I suppose this is, you know, based on nothing at all, but I mean, there is a very big company out there in the gambling industry that hasn't engaged in any M&A yet that maybe could do, and that's William Hill. So, I don't know, could we see a third party coming into this? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've not heard anything that that's the case, but just a thought aloud.
Yeah. Well, these guys, especially 888 GVC and bwin, they're struggling a little under the weight of extra taxation, aren't they, at the moment?
That is hitting all gambling companies. Yeah, it's the point of consumption tax, particularly for these three that we mentioned, which is the online-based tax. Yeah, it's hitting everyone, and different people are weathering it with a different ability. Like Paddy Power is absolutely fine. You know, it does have a retail presence, but it also is quite well, quite well established online, and they're managing fine, as are a lot of the other bigger players. But these smaller ones, it is hitting them a bit more.
And hence maybe the desire for consolidation there.
I think so. Yeah, it seems to be strength in size.
Hence, actually, also, I mean, if you look in this week's results section, then there are those three companies, but also Playtech, which is the only one we actually have on a buy, and it's possibly worth mentioning because you know that they're not actually a bookmaker, but that they offer kind of effectively gambling technology to a lot of these different companies.
Yeah, it's kind of like a geared play on the industry. Like it's
a play on the industry, but it's not affected by these specific issues. Which is why we
as you say, it's a technology provider, and they work with the biggest companies. And I spoke to Moore Weiser, hopefully that's how you pronounce his name, the chief executive of Playtech this week, and he seemed very optimistic about the fact that even though there is consolidation and arguably thereby less companies to work with, it would create good opportunities for his business. So he's optimistic about the trend that's happening, and Playtech itself seems to be doing particularly well. We've got it on a buy. It's worth reading that result and the relative gambling company results as well.
I mean, Playtech's been, it's a seriously big company now, isn't it? It's done incredibly well in recent years. But he was saying that, because I'm reading your piece here, that they are working with Ladbrokes and Coral, who are merging planning to, and Betfair and Paddy Power also merging. But that's going to create more business for them.
So he says.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I guess because of the, maybe it might only be in the short term because of the horrible word, but the synergies that might well need to be carried out as a result of two major businesses merging. But it seems like it makes sense that that would be the case. Whether it's for the long term, I'm not entirely sure, but in the short term,
One obviously has to judge management by their actions, not by their words. And the actions might suggest that they're looking to diversify, right? Because they've been buying these financial services business, most controversially Plus 500.
Yes.
Which it got at a very good price, probably, if it doesn't turn out to have been completely... So Plus 500, for those who didn't follow the story, had a very, very turbulent period earlier in the year when it, after many years of extraordinary growth, had to announce to the market that it had failed in some of its money laundering compliance functions. Mm. And the shares completely collapsed because they were propped up on a kind of sentiment.
Yeah, it was a very hot stock. Yeah.
Exactly. And so when hot stock suddenly kind of announces something wrong, then a lot of the heat suddenly comes out. And anyway, I can't remember quite what the shares did. Maybe they didn't quite halve, but they really did collapse quite dramatically.
They were pretty close.
And at that point, Playtex suddenly pounced and announced a takeover. So, it was very opportunistic, but...
It was. Looking at it, there is, in Plus 500's favour, I suppose, I from memory, they did initially submit a document to the FCA. I mean, one wonders, whether they really did that off their own back or whether they just were suggested to that should be the case. But they did submit a document which basically asked the FCA to, check its procedures, and then lo and behold, its procedures were not quite up to standard, and so they have been working to rectify that now, of course. And I think they've opened a good percentage of customer accounts again, which were frozen at the time because they weren't allowed to let these customers deal. You're right, it's a diversification. Does that mean that the amount of life left in the growth of the gambling industry is perhaps coming to an end? I don't know, but it's an interesting diversion into sort of CFD and financial derivatives businesses.
Just gambling, really, anyway, isn't it?
A different way, I suppose.
But it's interesting that they've moved into client-facing and customer-facing businesses there rather than being the back-end.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's different. That will be different for them. Although I suppose when you're buying a business, you are retaining the expertise of that business. So I mean, they will be hopeful that the staff at the companies they've bought will stay put, which it's not suggested that won't be the case.
Yeah.
And so they'll have the expertise to help them kind of navigate that market.
Well, good luck to them. We've got them on a buy, so that's good. And the only other, just wanted to look at one of the sort of theme running through the results here, Stephen, and we touched upon it earlier on a little bit. I've got a whole double page spread here of six results from the resources commodities sector, or various elements of it. Pretty grim out there, isn't it?
Yes, I must say, resources results do not make happy reading at the moment. Almost invariably, you get really quite steep falls in profits. If they're a miner or an oil producer, then obviously the price of the product they're selling has fallen very dramatically. And some of them have been able to increase production, but others haven't because of the usual operational issues. I mean, on the plus side, so we have Evraz and Petropavlovsk, both Russian focused.
So it's gold and steel.
Gold for Petropavlovsk and steel for Evraz. And both of those have actually found that their falls have been quite massively cushioned by the falling cost base because of their costs are denominated
in rubles,
but they're selling their goods in dollar denominated, in dollars effectively. So you get a sort of slightly odd effect there where the profits aren't quite as bad as the top line.
Yeah.
It's still not hugely pretty, and we don't have, we're not putting those on buy. We've got them on hold because they're very cheap, amazingly cheap. Evraz is on the under 5x consensus earnings, but
probably for a reason.
Exactly, but it's certainly, so it's a bit hard to say sell, but at the same time, it's sort of hard to gain the confidence in these kind of commodity markets to put them on a buy. So
we've got four oil services companies here, and you would have thought they'd all be getting hammered, they'll all be bombed out, but we've got certainly notably Cape is on a buy. Why is that?
It's a good question. And in the absence of Mark Robinson, our commodity specialist, who is just left for a well-earned holiday.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the valuation looks good, but
yeah, the valuation looks good, but then the valuation on most of them look pretty cheap. So, I mean, I guess it's a question of working out which ones are slightly less exposed to the ravages of the capital cuts, which have, you know, Shell and BP and all the rest of them have announced. The capital spending cuts, that is. I mean, and basically CAPE, the reason why we have CAPE on a buy, I mean, there are two reasons. One, it has a bias to maintenance revenues. So obviously oil rigs still need maintaining, even if big spending projects are one thing, maintenance projects are another. And also it has good exposure to the Middle East region, and notably national oil companies, which, you know, tend to have a sort of longer term focus than the publicly owned companies in the West. So OPEC has made no secret of the fact that it's sort of, well, until recently, it's been this sort of fairly unambiguous in saying that it will keep its production up.
Yes, indeed. And I've noticed them just from skim reading some of these results and over recent weeks, is that there's sort of that Middle East Gulf region has remained reasonably bright.
Exactly. I mean, so CAPE we've got on the buy. Lamprell, actually, which is based in Abu Dhabi, in UAE. I'm not sure if it's in Abu Dhabi or Dubai, but it's doing reasonably well. I mean, we've actually only got it on a hold. It won one of, I know Mark Robinson spoke to the chief executive there and learned that they won a contract with Abu Dhabi's National Drilling Company for one of only three jackup rigs ordered worldwide in the first 6 months, which says something about the state of the market.
Yeah, indeed. I know that Lamprell has had a tough time over the past year or so, though, hasn't it? I think last year it had some accounting issues.
Yeah, exactly. It did have some problems, which I think we had it on a buy at a certain point. We downgraded it and we've kept it there just because there was a trust issue, but actually it seems to be doing reasonably well.
But I mean, CAPE on Mark's pointed out, it's a 6% yield. And eight times forward earnings.
That's the other thing. Lamprell doesn't have a yield, so that's another reason why we've got CAPE, 6% yield. Same with AMEC, which we also have on a buy, it's almost 6% yield. So there's plenty of value. It's not obvious to see any reason why that would be crystallized anytime soon in these companies.
Yeah, well, it's a long-term game, as we say. Thanks, Stephen. And I think that pretty much wraps us up for today. The reason we've been talking about results and news in the main is that our cover feature this week is the mighty top 100 funds put together by Moira O'Neill. And this is an all-encompassing selection of our favourite funds. Moira's canvassed the opinions of 10 top advisors this year to give her a steer on some of the funds which were in our top 100 last year. So there's some changes, and there's some changes the way that the list has been put together. But it is a comprehensive and truly independent list of the top 100 funds. So worth buying the magazine for that alone as a long-term reference point. Also in the magazine this week, got John Barron's ever popular investment trust portfolio roundup, LG Hall's stock screen, and a sector focus on fashion.
Fashion retailers. Well, absolutely. And there's a video actually with a very illuminating discussion between Ian Smith, the deputy company's editor, and Harriet Russell, who wrote the piece, which is on the website.
It will be on the website I've edited it this afternoon. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. So yes, so £4.15, all good news agents. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. And see you next week.